Well, it would help.
Testing.
Testing. 1, 2, 3. This is an interview for the Brickmakers Oral History Project at Museum LA. The date is December 10th, 2008. And I'm at the Olin Arts Center at Bates College with Anthony Shostak, and this is Andrea Lumgia. Anthony, could you start just by giving me your full name?
It's Anthony J. Shostak, Anthony Joseph Shostak.
And how do you spell Shostak?
S-H-O-S-T-A-K.
And where and when were you born?
I was born here in Lewiston in 1967, August 6th, at St. Mary's Hospital.
And is this the community in which you grew up?
I grew up two blocks from here. I grew up on White Street, number 26.
And your parents, what were their names?
Stanley and Teresa Shostak.
And what did they do? What were their occupations?
My father, they were originally from Nashua, New Hampshire. My father worked in the shoe industry there. He was middle management. His company moved him to Lewiston in 1966, and then the shoe industry shortly thereafter went downhill. So for most of my life, my father was actually unemployed. He held several short-term jobs, the last of which I think was with the U.S. Post Office. My mother, out of necessity, left being a homemaker, I think, in probably 1974, and became a secretary, and eventually became the head of print and mailing services here at Bates.
And did you have brothers and sisters?
I am the last of 10 children.
Oh my. So you're the youngest.
I am the youngest of 10, yes. And the only real Mainer of the bunch.
The others
are all born in New Hampshire. Yeah.
So are you a lot younger than the rest, or?
No, we're pretty evenly spread out over, almost a 20-year span. So my oldest sister, I think, is 17 or 18 years older than I am. Mm-hmm. And, every year or two, there had to be a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, interesting. So your parents really had a lot of work to...
Yeah, good, typical Catholic family at the time.
Yeah. Now, growing up in Lewiston, what was it like in the 60s and 70s? Well, 70s, right?
Yeah.
And 80s.
I remember becoming increasingly bored by Lewiston. This building didn't exist when I was growing up. A lot of the shops downtown were sort of closing down. I remember when the malls opened, and that was a huge sort of something to do. But my family didn't have a reliable car, so we couldn't frequently go down to the beach or anything in the summertime. I was stuck here in Lewiston.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what did you do for social activities outside of school?
Yeah, well, luckily, we grew up in a neighborhood where there were a lot of kids my age, and so there was a very strong bunch of kids to play with. So we would, I sort of remark to people today that I never see the kids playing the way we did when I was growing up anymore. Mm-hmm. Basically unsupervised, with a wide range of kids from, 4 years old or 3 years old all the way up to 15. Just playing kick the can, or I don't even know that kids even know how to play kick the can anymore. So there was a lot of just outside neighborhood play, or come to Bates Pond and find crayfish and frogs and stuff like that. Find frog eggs and let's hatch them and things like that. So we found things to do, and generally stayed out of trouble. Because there was a gentleman on our street who was the alderman for our whatever here in Lewiston. And so if we ever started to do anything that was a little, like building cannon guns or things like that. The police showed up pretty quickly. In those days, the police actually, I remember the police walking through the neighborhood. So it was a very, very different kind of city then.
Right.
I think it was a lot friendlier to little kids. We went to the library a lot. The library was a great resource, and within, I could walk down there with an older sibling and, go back down and down there and back in an afternoon. So that was pretty fun.
Now, at what point did you become involved with brickmaking?
It was the summer that I graduated from high school. My next oldest brother and I, Matthew, were both looking for jobs. He was currently studying at Notre Dame, and I was trying to save money to go to art school, and we needed summer jobs. We weren't having very much luck, so I just happened to be dropping off, I forget what it was, it might have been a jacket or something for one of my friends at his house, Rick Veyut, and he lived out on Old Green Road. And his dad answered the door, and he asked what we were doing for the summer, and we told him we didn't have any plans yet. And he said, I just heard that Morin LaChance is hiring people, so you get out there. So that very, as soon as we finished that little conversation, he and I drove over to the Morin LaChance Brickyard and basically said, we heard you guys are looking for help. And they signed us up to be brick strippers. Which sounds pretty glamorous, but it was a great job because we made a pretty good wage compared to other things that were available. I had another job working at the local movie theater, the Northwood Twin, which doesn't exist anymore, and I made a lot more money making bricks.
Yeah. Now, what is a brick stripper?
As brick strippers, we stripped pallets that had air-dried bricks on them, waiting to be baked in the kiln. And so they would be delivered to a shed that was, roofed an outdoor shed roofed in tin, with a conveyor belt running from the shed down to a lower area. And the brick strippers would go through these bricks. These huge pallets were delivered by forklift, and we would go through, I think there were probably 6 or 8 stacks of pallets, and they were, I forget how many deep they were, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 stack deep. And there were these, pretty heavy raw bricks that were just kind of air dried, and we'd have to insert our fingers between the bricks, push the bricks together, sort of flick them out with our fingers, catch them, and then put them on a conveyor belt. But they had to be turned, they all had to be turned the same way. So the bottom had to be facing down the belt. And, it was piecework. I forget exactly how much we made. It was a ridiculously tiny amount per brick when you thought, I'm only getting this per brick. But, we must have moved thousands and thousands of these things a day, a piece. I think there were 4 of us in the shed. And there were another 4 guys down at the other end of the conveyor belt, and those guys would pick up the bricks at their end, and they would stack them with this elaborate system that would allow the air to really sort of travel through this big cube, but it was kind of an open cube, so that the bricks would dry efficiently in the kiln. And then I think that they were then allowed to air dry a little bit more, and then they were tossed off. Excuse me.
And so we were talking about the process, and they were stacking them in a certain way so that the air would circulate.
That's right. So that these were open cubes, and they specifically so that when they were put into the kiln, they would dry pretty efficiently. And I think that that after they were stacked this way, they were then allowed to dry a little longer. In fact, I think that, in the summertime, I think we were basically trying to make the rest of, this very long supply of bricks that could last the factory through the winter. Because I'm not sure that they could have done the actual, molding of the bricks in freezing temperatures. I don't.
Right.
I honestly don't remember, and wasn't trained in those other aspects of the job, so I'm not really sure.
Yeah. Now this was the mid '80s.
This was 1986.
'86, and so were the kilns oil fired by then, or so they were still fueled by wood?
I don't know.
Yeah. I wondered if
they were
that technology had.
I don't know. I don't remember seeing huge stacks of cordwood or anything, so maybe they had already made the transition to oil. But
right. Yeah, so you that
not what I needed to know to
right.
And they're really, it was so loud, you know, you couldn't really talk to anybody anyway. Once the conveyor started, it was, you know, you just were in your own head, or shouting at somebody to be heard.
And so how many hours a day would you work that?
It was usually about 8. Sometimes there were special orders and they would ask for, you know, voluntary overtime. But that didn't happen all that much. With us, I think there were a couple of other guys who were much more willing to do the extra overtime. So I didn't do that very often. And you know, I had another job to get to, for the evening. So it's not like I could do that. But right. I think we started at 7 o'clock in the morning. It could have been 6:30, but I think it was 7, and we went, you know, till 3:30 or something like that.
And you just got as many bricks through there as you could because you got paid by the brick.
Yes. Yep. There was there were occasionally periods of downtime when the conveyor would break or, you know, for some sort of mechanical reason we had to stop. But generally we just whizzed as fast as we could. And there was sometimes, you know, there was sometimes tension between between the strippers and the guys who were actually building those cubes, because that was a little bit more intricate work than what we were doing, and so we kind of had to time our. It was not efficient to move absolutely as fast as you could, because you would then outstrip the other guy's ability to actually get these cubes made, and if you stopped the conveyor, it was actually less efficient than just keeping a somewhat slower but steadier stream. Although sometimes we would do it intentionally just because we wanted a break. you thought, I really need... And, you know, this was a summer, if I remember right. We just had heat wave after heat wave. And you're under this metal roof, and it's dusty. And, you know, it was just unbelievably hot work and very physical. The first day that we got there, the foreman, who I think his name was Turcotte, you know, he sort of introduced us to the job, and he told the whole crew, and we were all college kids, or that's not true. There were a couple of guys who weren't, but they were about the same age as us, and he said, okay, now this is what you're going to do, and tonight you will. I can still remember his words. He says, "You will experience extreme physical discomfort. Do not quit. You know, come back tomorrow. Tomorrow you will experience extreme physical discomfort worse than today. Don't quit. You know, if you can stick it out for 3 or 4 days, you'll be fine." He gave everybody a tube of Bengay to go home with that night, and he was right. It was really, you discovered muscles you just didn't know that you had. And I remember just collapsed. I got home and I just collapsed and fell asleep as soon as I had eaten dinner. And there were a couple guys who just, they couldn't do it. They just couldn't hack it. One guy wound up working the forklift for the rest of the summer. And I think a couple other guys just were like, this is ridiculous. I'll get a job somewhere else.
Yeah. Now, was that the only summer you worked there, or did you come back other years?
That was the single summer. Despite the fact that it was reasonably lucrative, it was a painful job, and a very unpleasant one in terms of you know, it was just hot and dusty and thirsty and just really, you know, and loud. So I had the opportunity to do other work that was similar, you know, also in, you know, I worked for an electrician, and so it was probably more deadly, although I didn't really think about that at the time. Although I didn't get fatalgrams with my paycheck as I did at the Brickyard, which was sort of an amusing thing to me. So here's your paycheck, and here's a story of how somebody got killed on the job. Oh, not necessarily at the factory, but I think it was a program that I'm sure their insurance company said, you know, we'll give you a break if you put fatalgrams in your paychecks. So nice. Stories of people working on forklifts underneath a load and things like that. So, but it was a neat experience.
Did you end up going to art school that fall?
I did, yeah. I went to the University of the Arts in Philadelphia and came back to the Lewiston area, I think, every summer to just earn money. I could sublet my apartment and earn more here than I could down there. You couldn't, you know, you had to join a union to get a job as an electrician or a carpenter or whatever down there. And that required money or connections and time, which I didn't have. Mm-hmm. So I could come back here and do the work at home and escape the ridiculous summer heat of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
and enjoy.
And so, when did you have that desire to go to art school? Was it in high school or earlier?
Yeah, it was pretty early on. I decided I thought it'd be kind of neat to be an artist. I think it was after I gave up being, wanting to be an astronaut, realizing that I probably was, you know, too small and had too bad vision to fly jets, and that it just wasn't going to happen. So, I decided to pursue an art career.
And what specifically did you study, or what have you gone into?
I studied painting and sculpture. The summer before my senior year in high school, I was given a free ride to attend a summer program for high school students at the same school. It was then called the Philadelphia College of Art. You did a little bit of everything. You did some sculpture and graphic design and drawing and stuff. But in my mind, you know, for whatever ridiculous reason, as a little kid, I always thought, well, real artists paint. So that's what I'm going to be. That's what I studied. And so very, you know, I love painting.
Yeah. So you still actively paint?
Not so much lately. I have a young child who makes sustained activity that doesn't involve him difficult. I've exhibited around the state and around and down in Philadelphia. I've had work in an international traveling exhibition called Revolutions of the World. That was organized by a German man named Siegfried Cotton. I was invited to exhibit paintings in Havana, Cuba. I've had a short and interesting career as an artist.
And you've been here at Bates for how long?
15 years.
Wow. So you found a spot right in Lewiston.
I never ever. I
not
left
intentionally.
Yeah, well. A little bit, actually, but when I left Lewiston, I said, goodbye, Lewiston, you know, when I was a teenager and went away to college. This building actually opened a few months after I went for my freshman year of art school. At the time, Lewiston didn't seem to be a particularly attractive place to me. After living in Philadelphia for a number of years, I got tired of living in the city and started thinking about, it would be nice to find work in somewhere else, somewhere closer to most of my family. And at the time, around that time, one of my colleagues here, Bill Lowe, had to finish his master's degree, so he was going to take a leave of absence from his position here. He called me up and asked if I would be interested in coming back. I had interned here. I had volunteered to here 1 year or one summer. I forget what year that was. The summer of 91, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so Bill, you know, asked if I would be interested in a 6 or 8 month position. And I said, yeah, sure. You know, I'm kind of tired of Philadelphia. So I came back and I've been here ever since. They can't get rid of me.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Is there anything that you feel I haven't asked you about regarding BRICS or something significant as to who you are and that that you'd like to add?
I don't know. I went to local parochial school, so I went to St. Joseph's and then St. Dominic's. I now play music with Greg Boardman and another guy from Lewiston, John Cody. We're in a quartet with a gentleman from Winthrop. And we play the local Lewiston Contra Dance. Yeah. 8 or 9 months a year or something like that.
What instrument do you play?
I play Illan pipes. It's an Irish bagpipe. I also play banjo.
Great. Thank you so much.
Sure.
We just want to add one more story before we end.
There was one of the highlights of the day was the arrival of the high style catering truck, which came, you know, sort of mid-morning. It was, you know, like the coffee break. And you would sort of, your stomach would start to grumble and you'd be getting thirsty or whatever, and you'd just be wanting, a break. And so you'd start looking out over the top of your glasses, or if you wore, I guess we probably all had to wear glasses, actually, safety glasses. But you know, you'd be looking for that dust on the road that approached the brickyard, because chances are it would be the high style truck. And as soon as you could make it out, you know, there would be this cry that you would hear going out across the yard. You know, everybody everybody said it the same way. It was this that you just hear, "Hey, stop!" And it would just sort of echo across the, you know, everybody would take up the cry, "Hey, stop!" And then, you know, the machines would all sort of come to an abrupt halt and people would cheer and jump out and run up to the truck to get their coffee or Danish or whatever. Interestingly, most of the guys in my crew didn't partake of the high style truck because it just was, we were college kids who were way too hungry to be satisfied by just a Danish or whatever. So we would bring, you know, each of us had a couple of gallons of water. We'd freeze the night before. We'd freeze these gallon jugs of water and bring those, sometimes more, or sometimes it would be iced tea or whatever. Usually just water. And then just huge amounts of... There was one guy who had, usually he had 3 or 4 bananas that he would eat during break, because you're just going through that many calories. Yeah. So it was fun. But the high style truck was something that I will probably remember to the day that I die, that cry. And every time I drive or in the part of town where the high style had their business, I would ride by and with friends or whatever, and I would see the sign and I'd say, "Hi, Starl!" And they'd look at me like I was from Mars. But, so.
Well, thank you for adding that.
Sure.